Good afternoon and welcome to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks very much for tuning in to your local campus and community radio station. Andy Jones here with a radio show that I know you're going to love because I've got two great established multi-book authoring award-winning poets, both first-time poets on this radio show this afternoon. The first will be Millicent Borges-Accardi. She's received one of the rare fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as the California Arts Council and the Barbara Deming Foundation. Her work has appeared in over 50 publications, including Nimrod, Tampa Review, New Letters, and Wallace Stevens Journal, as well as in a great number of anthologies. She has a chapbook out called Woman on a Shaky Bridge, and she'll be giving a reading on August 12th in Los Angeles. I've invited her to come on the program to talk about her work, her poetry, our mutual respect and appreciation for one Mr. James Reagan, and to read a few of her poems. In the second half of the show, we will hear from Randall Mann. Randall Mann is the author of the poetry collections Breakfast with Thomas Gunn, which was a finalist for the California Book Award and the Lambda Literary Award, as well as Complaint in the Garden, which won the Kenyon Review Prize. He is the co-author of the textbook Writing Poems, which I have consulted many times for one of my freshman seminars, and he has published poems in all of the greatest journals, including Poetry, Paris Review, and The New Republic. We'll be joined by Randall Mann in the second half of the program. That, some jazz in between, and perhaps your calls as we gear up for a reading tonight by Molly Fisk at Bistro 33 as part of the Poetry Night reading series. That's tonight at 8 o'clock. You might have heard Molly Fisk on Capital Public Radio this morning. Well, this evening you can hear her at 8 at Bistro 33, but not before you hear my interviews live here on KDVS on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We'll be right back. After this important musical bit by one Mr. John Hicks. I've got a John Hicks CD in my hand here. It is called Evidence. Let's hear some evidence of great jazz from John Hicks here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Be right back with Millicent Accardi. Thank you. This is Andy Jones with Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Always thankful that you're here to support your campus and community radio station. Remember that this is just one of 10 public affairs programs that you can hear Monday through Friday on KDBS. Other shows include the soon-to-be Nationwide This Week in Science, It's About You, Radio Parallax, and Speaking in Tongues. To find out more, point your browser at kdvs.org. Millicent Borges-Accardi is my first guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the California Arts Council, the Barbara Deming Foundation, and Formby Special Collections at Texas Tech University. Her poetry and other publications have appeared in over 50 publications, including Nimrod, Tampa Review, New Letters, and Wallace Stevens Journal, as well as in a great number of anthologies, including Boomer Girls from Iowa Press and Chopin with Cherries from Moonrise Press. She has enjoyed residencies at Yaddo, Gentel, and the Vermont Studio, and her chapbook, Woman on a Shaky Bridge, is with Finishing Line Press. She's also got two full-length collections that are forthcoming, Injuring Eternity from Mischievous Muse Press, Winter 2010, and then Only More So, Salmon Poetry Ireland, Spring 2012. She graduated from University of Southern California with an MPW degree in 1993, and her current chapbook, Woman on a Shaky Bridge, is available at Amazon.com. Millicent Borges-Accardi, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I came across you in part because on one of your websites, you had mentioned that you would work with a poet who I have a lot of respect for, and that is James Reagan. James Reagan's been on this radio show a few times, as I mentioned to you via email. So I thought I'd ask, how was it that you had the occasion to work with James Reagan, and how would you characterize him and his work for people who don't know it?
He was the director of the creative writing program when I was at USC in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And he also taught a couple of poetry classes there, the advanced workshops. And then the summer before I graduated, I had such a privilege to go to Prague for a semester and study there at the Central European University, where we took classes from Jim as one of the teachers. And he brought maybe 5 or 6 of our students over there for the summer semester. And since that time, I've kept in touch with him, and I've been on a couple of panels and done some readings at AWP with Jim, you know, throughout the years. And I, you know, consider him a great poet and a really good friend and mentor.
Absolutely. And someone with a generous spirit who presents that in full display at his poetry readings. They're always great events, great performances when you can see James Reagan read.
He has wonderful, you know, meaningful work, and he has a great sense of humor, too.
Absolutely. Well, tell me about your own work. How would you characterize the poetry, for instance, that we find in your chapbook, Woman on a Shaky Bridge, or your forthcoming books, Injuring Eternity and Only More So?
It's really hard to characterize anything one writes. I kind of send it out into the universe and hope for the best.
Right.
Some people have said about me that my most successful poems are poems about other people. So I like to be a witness, an observer, and kind of take notes. And I tend to write about places I visit or people that I meet. The chapbook has sort of a motley crew of collected family stories and friend stories, as well as a series of poems about Eastern Europe and Prague in general. And so it's kind of a little collection of poems, mostly about women and women's experience in the world.
In terms of your own experience, at USC and your work now as a Los Angeles poet. Were you born and raised in Southern California?
I was. I grew up in Long Beach, and then I moved to Los Angeles. And so I'm a Southern California native, but my family originally came from Massachusetts, and then before that, the Azores. So I'm a Portuguese-American poet.
Interesting.
And I love to travel, and so I've spent a lot of time abroad, mostly in Europe. So I'm not just sticking close to home all the time.
Absolutely. In terms of your own work as a poet, do you find that you focus more on the work that you do as a performer and as part of a poetry community there in Los Angeles, or do you find that you focus more on publications and relationships with readers and editors who you might not ever meet in person, or do you think of your poetry life in some other way?
I focus mostly on the work, making poems. I think it's a pretty solo activity. I did start a women's poetry group a couple years ago. We meet once a month, and we share poems, and we've had a nice sense of community from that. I never consider my poetry to be made for a performance. I write it for the page.
Right.
And I like readers to, you know, read it to themselves. Although I do enjoy giving readings, I typically don't write or with a performance in mind, or nor do I consider myself a performance poet. I also, you know, considered a lot of, since your show is poetry and technology, my day job is as a technical writer, instructional designer. And so I do a lot of e-learning, and I work on blogs and things with the community that way. So I feel like the electronic vehicle of my community, as well as my women's writing group, those are the two senses of community I have. Otherwise, I'm, you know, by myself writing, working with the page.
That's the way to do it. I guess the what you said about electronic community is really interesting. In his famous essay, Can Poetry Matter, in 1991, Dana Joy lamented what was happening to poetry communities over the previous half century. But then in an amendment to that famous essay, which appeared in The Atlantic, he wrote that two things that made him somewhat less pessimistic. One was the ease with which people could share poetry and kind of establish themselves as poets using electronic means. And then the other is the opportunity for especially young people to share performed works as well as memorized works of their own and works memorized by other more famous poets. And that would be another way of forming a community. So when we come back from this quick break, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the technological work that you do. And then we'd love to hear a poem.
Okay.
All right. My guest this afternoon is Millicent Borges-Accardi. That's spelled A-C-C-A-R-D-I. I mention that because she's got a nice website that she set up herself. And I encourage you to investigate that if you're interested in seeing some quality poetry websites. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. And now, a word from our sponsor.
This hour of programming is brought to you courtesy of the Yolo County Federal Credit Union. The Yolo County Federal Credit Union is a nonprofit financial cooperative with locations throughout Yolo County. The Yolo County Federal Credit Union offers a wide range of financial services and can be reached by phone at 530-668-2700 or online at yolofcu.org.
This is Dr. Andy of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS, 90.3 FM, Davis, Sacramento. I'd like to remind you that tonight, here in the city of Davis, is Poetry Night. That means that this evening, because it's the first Wednesday of the month, Molly Fisk will be joining us. She is a poet who was born in San Francisco, now considers Nevada City her home, author of a number of books. She earned her BA from Radcliffe College, Harvard University, and her MBA from Simmons College, the Graduate School of Management. She's the author of Listening to Winter, The More Difficult Beauty and Terrain, as well as a number of chapbooks. She won the Dogwood Prize, the Robinson Jeffers Torhaus Prize in Poetry, and the Billy Murray Denny Prize, among others. She'll be reading tonight at Bistro 33 at 226 F Street in the city of Davis. You might have heard her on Capital Public Radio this morning. Opening for her will be Zoe Keithley, a Sacramento poet who has appeared on this radio show before. This afternoon, we're talking to Millicent Borges-Accardi. She is a Los Angeles-based poet who has received numerous fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the California Arts Council. She has placed poems in over 50 publications and a number of anthologies as well. Her most recent book is a chapbook called Woman on a Shaky Bridge, and she's got two books coming out in upcoming years. I'm very pleased that she could join us this afternoon on the live line. So, Millicent, tell me more about the ways that creativity and writing intersect with technology for you, especially during your day job, and if you find any inspiration for poems there.
You know, I can't say that I've written a computer poem or an IT poem as yet, but I definitely find parallels in what I do as a day job. I typically write training manuals, or I do e-learning or instructional design, and so often I'm puzzling over just the right word in the right place and the right moment for the right effect.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the same thing that I do in a poem. I try to match what's in my brain with what appears on the page. And so I feel like it's all sort of the same technique or the same path. And for me, at least, I can kind of slip in between both worlds. I've been a huge fan of computers and laptops ever since they came out. I try to have the first one that comes out if I can. Just like the Kindle, I really like the Kindle, too. I know there are some people that don't like it, but...
I'm an iPad myself, but you're a big fan of the Kindle. You probably appreciate that it's lighter than an iPad, for instance.
I really like it. I think I was in line for a pre-order when they first came out, and for me, traveling, instead of having a suitcase full of books, I can load up, 20, 30 books on the Kindle, and then it's good for a few days. And the thing is, sometimes with a line break, it's not so great for poetry. But poetry books typically are smaller, so I usually have a few of those in my suitcase, and it's not a problem. And then I'll load the novels and the magazines and blogs and some other things onto the Kindle. So I really like it.
Excellent. And have you thought of getting one of these, didn't they announce some smaller Kindles just last week?
Did.
And so that probably
like
bugs you. Right. So that probably annoys you as an early adopter.
No, I'm looking at it. I was looking at the models. It was like 390 or something, and then they're coming out with this new one in the middle of the month for like 179, I think. And it looks smaller, and the battery lasts longer, and it has the global internet, which you can do the instant whisper net downloads of books and newspapers when you're abroad.
So, right.
Mine does not have that, so I'm looking at the new one. But I haven't purchased it yet.
As a traveler, I'm sure the ability to travel with all those books but not be overwhelmed by them in terms of the cumbersome suitcases, I'm sure that's a big advantage for you.
I do like that. And then when I go on residencies, I'm often somewhere. I was in Chesky Krumlov for a month last fall, and I just bring my Kindle. It's great.
Wonderful. Well, Millicent Borges-Accardi is my guest this afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. She's a Los Angeles-based poet. You're going to be giving a reading on August 12th?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to say a little bit more about that for our Los Angeles listeners?
It's LA Art Core at the Union Center for the Arts. It's on Judge John Aliso Street in Los Angeles and Little Tokyo. It's part of the Arts Walk there. I'm reading with Michelle Biting, and it's August 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. They have a web page. You can just look up LA Art Core, and you can find the events there, or you can, you know, ping me on Facebook, too.
Excellent. Well, I think people at home would like to hear less talk about poetry and more poetry. Do you have something there that you could share with us?
Sure. I picked a piece. This is sort of about a woman surviving in an occupied country, and this is part of the selection of what I call Prague or Eastern European poems in my chapbook.
Excellent. Let's hear it. And remind us one more time the name of your most recent chapbook.
Woman on a Shaky Bridge.
Excellent. Great. Millicent Borges-Zicardi, let's hear your first poem.
Only more so. You see, it was very much like this. In the flatland dregs, the fat-coated soldiers knocked at the door, so a woman was forced, with a gritty smile, to invite them in, to sit by her yellow fire, to swallow up her walls. In the corner, her husband rubbed a wooden rifle, tapped wooden boots against a wooden floor, thinking, visitors are cold as bad luck. He looped his fingers under his belt and turned into gravel. The soldiers, making circles in the dust on the hearth, asked the woman to remember the unremembered, the jewelry she sold for food, the Moravian lace curtains. Where are rings? Two and now one? The woman spun her wedding band around her finger and gave them her best. We were here before you, glare. Surrounded by dust and half-opened words, the woman's eyes brought a dull patina to their repeated questions. The sharp wool collars of the soldiers pointed south. Inside, the benches evaporated into firewood. It was like this. The woman's hips swayed like harmonicas when the men watched her fetch water and run it into the basin, cracking ice with her fingernails. They asked her, "Why do trees mean? And what does water stand for?" Well, their stares mocked the broken windows, and pain itself counted the woman's buttons as they easily slipped through the stitching of her clothing. You see, it was all so simple. They wanted the smooth golden of her neck, the warm nest of her skirt, her losses shifting like daggers beneath their skin. As wind fragmented, as doors burned, as fires latched, this last woman, clutched a bowl to her chest, knowing what the snow outside pretended, knowing that nothing important ever belonged to her, that now she must survive by owning air, by holding back the red, the full, the bare, the proud canvases of flat language paper that once told her everything she needed to know. It was like this, only more so.
Oh, that's very nice. Only More So is the name of your 2012 book from Salmon Poetry Ireland?
It is. It's from that poem.
Good. And say a little bit more about living in Eastern Europe. I'm wondering how many of your interactions with frightening authority figures were resulted from interviews or your imagination or stories you've heard, or how many such exchanges you actually endured while you were there?
Frightening experience. There was one. I took a train from Prague to Berlin, and the first time I was in Prague was in 93, which was pretty close to when the wall came down in 89, and so I was there the summer. There was like the first American bookstore, the first McDonald's, and people were kind of getting used to the idea of tourists.
Right.
So, and then I was also there last fall, which I saw a big difference. But anyway, I would take the train on the weekends when I was there. And so I took the train to Berlin for a little weekend and to kind of see that city in Germany. And a group of us, or maybe five of us, went together. And we had like these little rooms on the train with the couches that faced each other, and they came by and asked for your tickets, and then they asked for your passports, and we were traveling at night, and we gave up our passports, and it seemed like hours, and they didn't come back, and we saw no one. We went through the cars, we're looking, and they were all empty, and suddenly we got terrified. We're in a, you know, foreign country. We don't have our passports. We're not really all that sure of whether we were ever getting them back or not. And so that was probably my moment of terror. But they did return the passports. We did see Berlin, and everything was fine. But there was that moment.
when you were rightly concerned. And did you ever figure out what the problem was? Why they were holding on to your passports for so long?
I never did. I did think of something else, though. When I was coming back, I had my laptop with me with all the... At that time, I had the little mini... they weren't floppy, but they were like hard diskettes.
Right.
And when I was trying to get out through the airport in Prague, they detained me, and they went through every one of my pieces of my stockings, and because they were so puzzled by these little discs.
Oh, I see.
But that was fine, too, and I got on the plane, and everything was okay.
Well, I'm glad it all worked out for you. But you did get a sense of what it is to travel with diminished liberties compared to what we enjoy here in the United States.
Yes.
Interesting. Well, if you're just joining us, Millicent Borges-Accardi is my guest. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent is Woman on a Shaky Bridge, which is for sale at Amazon and probably other places as well. She has placed poems in a great number of journals. Well, Millicent, we have time to hear one more poem. Do you have another one there that you could share with us?
I do. This is a newer one, and it's for the poet Leslie Scalapino, who recently passed away.
Yes.
And it's sort of written in her style, and it got taken on a memorial site on the web about works by her. So, and it's a fairly short one, so I thought I'd share that one with you guys.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Sewing the black. Sewing the black silk irises to pause, to sit, to listen for their clothness, or the tears of the silk from worms we know not of nor ever discuss. Turning the bulb turned inwards to the light inside the outside of a part of us all. She told us of thoughts deepened in her own water, then other randoms, like houses that drew themselves to the surface. Sitting now over the last bed of the one who made poetry, into the conjoined pipes of the sad song, we run through like a medieval maze of roses. No, not roses. Silk, irises, black, the ones we are sewing now to say goodbye.
Very nice. Thank you for remembering Leslie Scalapino with that poem here on this radio show. And thank you so much for sharing with us your poetry and your stories. You'll be giving a reading this coming August 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. And can you tell us the location one more time?
Sure. It's in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles at L.A. Art Core Union Center for the Arts. It's part of the Los Angeles Art Walk event.
Well, Millicent Borges-Accardi, I very much enjoyed hearing your poetry and appreciate you taking some time this afternoon to appear on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You have a good evening.
You too.
You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. We'll be right back. I have two important messages for you. One is that tonight is poetry night. Molly Fisk will be reading at Bistro 33 at 226 F Street here in the city of Davis. If you'd like to find out more, you can visit poetryindavis.com. The other is an important message from St. John's Retirement Village. St. John's Retirement Village reminds us that the elderly are often the forgotten people in our community. If you know a senior citizen with nutritional or transportation needs, lend a hand. If you know a senior with little or no family, lend your heart. Be the one who cares and give your time. This message is brought to you by St. John's Retirement Village in Woodland. You may reach them at 530-662-9674. They're on the air because they care about the welfare of our seniors. This is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. I'm going to get Randall Mann on the live line telephone here in just a moment. But first, I'd like to share with you this important message from the Linux Users Group of Davis.
The Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019. Or via email at root@lugod.org.
Back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. I wanted to remind you that Molly Fisk will be reading tonight at Poetry Night Reading Series at Bistro 33, and Zoe Keithley will be opening for her. Zoe Keithley is a Sacramento poet, a prize-winning poet, who authored the book Crow Song, which was picked up by Roan Press, a Sacramento-based mostly poetry press that has really been putting out great work. I try to celebrate and boost local publishers and local poets whenever I can. I'm really pleased that Zoe Keithley will be able to join us tonight to open for Molly Fisk at Poetry Night at Bistro 33. Randall Mann is my next guest this afternoon on KDBS. Randall Mann is the author of the poetry collections Breakfast with Tom Gunn from University of Chicago Press. That was a 2009 publication. That book was a finalist for the California Book Award and the Lambda Literary Award. He's also the author of Complaint in the Garden, a 2003 book that won the Kenyon Review Prize. Randall Mann also co-authored the textbook Writing Poems, which, as I mentioned earlier, I consulted as I was putting together a freshman seminar called Three Poems a Week. It's really a top-notch textbook that if I were writing poetry, I would consult. His poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine, Paris Review, and New Republic, and I'll just say that those are three of the places where any poet would most like to see his or her work. He lives in San Francisco and joins us today on the live line. Randall Mann, welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. I'm glad that this time worked out for you. Yeah. And we talked a little bit electronically earlier about Tom Gunn, who is obviously an important inspiration for your book, Breakfast with Tom Gunn. And not all listeners may know of this important British and American poet and a very important Bay Area poet. So I'm wondering if you could, if we could start by you telling us a little bit about Tom Gunn and how he was important enough to you to have you title your most recent book, Breakfast with Tom Gunn.
Absolutely. Tom Gunn was a British poet who was born in 1929, and he came to California. He came to Stanford to study with the poet and critic Ivor Winters, and that was in the 50s, and he stayed and made San Francisco his home, and he taught for many years at Berkeley, and he was a great influence for me because, you know, when I was in high school and I was sort of really discovering poetry, I guess maybe in earnest, I read a poem of his called On the Move, and it was really, there was something really sexy and beautiful and about the whole thing, and so I read it, and I noted it, and I filed it away, and then later on, when I was studying poetry, I came across his work, and it was really sort of amazing how he straddled both this kind of classicism and a very sort of contemporary, alive, sexual duende, and he's you know, a kind of seeming paradox, which I don't really think it is, but he's a very sort of a very classical and formal poet at times, but in those very traditional forms, he often wrote about both overtly sexual things, and then later on in his great book, The Man with Night Sweats, he wrote very painful poems about some of the losses that he and our community suffered from AIDS. And so, you know, I found that his aesthetic was very appealing to me, and as I started writing, because I love writing in forms, but I also like writing in free verse, and Tom Gunn did both of those really quite adeptly. It's hard to think of another poet, say, perhaps Stevens, who could write in and out of form, you know, so expertly. And, of course, he was a queer poet. I'm a queer poet. And there's that layer as well. So very important. Very important poet to me, to the Bay Area, and I like it that he's sort of unclassifiable.
Right.
Confuses people because he's like, wait, why would a gay poet write in, you know, why would he write in such, you know, very strict forms, and isn't, you know, wouldn't he just sort of write more loosey-goosey, and how do we put him? Do we put him with the formalists? Do we put him with the queers? Do we put him, you know, with the Brits? Do we put him with the Americans? Do we? And I love that he resists taxonomy. I think that's fantastic. That's really appealing too.
He's such a strong poet that one might guess that, as what happened with Eliot in the middle of the last century, that anthologies of both British and American poetry, those editors will both want to claim him and put them in their anthologies. And certainly, The Man with Night Sweats is an incredible and moving book. I'd say one of the top 10 books of poetry to have been published in last 20, 25 years. And so if folks are wondering what's a book of poetry that's worth picking up and that'll really be present a rewarding read, I would encourage them to check out that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very special book. I think in particular the part four of the book, which contains so many of the sort of direct elegies. I mean, it's a beautiful book, and it sort of takes its arc, sort of moves in different directions. But then at the end there, this is an extraordinarily bracing ending. And I do think you're right, sort of like Auden. I mean, it's, you know, people on both sides of the pond will want to claim him.
Right.
You know? So.
Yeah, Auden's another good example. Now, you had mentioned the Tom Gunn poem, On the Move. Was that one of his early motorcycle poems?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Man, you gotta go. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, straight up, you know, you can see the oil and the leather, and you know, see sort of, you know, maybe picture early Brando in the background, sort of.
Right.
It's a very exciting period piece. And it's super gay. So, yeah, it's from an early book. Sure.
That's great. And I remember encountering that when I was younger. It might have been one of the works, along with a few by, let's say, Jack Kerouac, that brought me to California from the East Coast.
Right.
If you're just joining us this afternoon, This is Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDBS, and Randall Mann is my guest. He's the author of two books. We've been talking about Tom Gunn, one of the subjects of Breakfast with Tom Gunn, which is the University of Chicago press book that came out last year, as well as the 2003 book Complaint in the Garden, which won the Kenyon Review Prize. So, Randall, you alluded earlier to some of the early inspiration that you received from Tom Gunn and other poets, but I'm wondering if you could trace the arc of your own career as a poet and scholar and teacher and anthologist. What else got you started, and how is it that you've reached where you are now?
Well, I, you know, when I was a kid, there was a big collected Robert Frost on the table, and you know, I think I thumbed through that without necessarily knowing what it was, and I sort of read all, you know, like Fire and Ice and The Road Not Taken. I think I must have read all the wrong Frost, which later on, in great essays by Randall Jarrell and William Logan, I learned more about the other Frost and the other Frost, as those essays are called, the kind of darker, more unforgiving Frost,
right.
Like Of a Hundred Colors, or you know, some of those great poems in North of Boston, etc. And then I loved Keats as a kid. Parents gave me that fairly early, and then had a great, really encouraging teacher in high school. And then when I went to college, I studied with William Logan and a poet named Deborah Greger, and they were very encouraging and introduced me to a lot of translations. You know, I read Miroslav Holub, and I read Pablo Neruda, like the Odes, when I was 19 or 20, and I saw the possibilities of language and what happens when language gets ferried across through translation. And I think that was particularly important and taught me to sort of look outside and see what other sensibilities were. I found that great Wesleyan anthology that that Bishop did on Brazilian poets and things of that sort. So there was that. And, you know, I fell in love with Donald Justice, who used to teach at my alma mater, University of Florida.
Right.
And I fell hard for Donald Justice. I couldn't believe how beautiful and funny and clear it all was. And sort of with my sort of lacking middle class education, I sort of came to Stevens first after coming to Donald Justice, because you know Donald Justice has a really fine elegy for Stevens, and then I thought, oh, and then I read Stevens, and so I kind of had this weird trajectory of reading that it was not very linear, but and then you know I studied with the poet critic William Logan, and it was very he likes very formal poems, so I he introduced you know Larkin, Philip Larkin. And I read more Auden then, and then it was Hardy, and Anthony Hecht, very important to me, and Marianne Moore, Elizabeth Bishop. So, and those are all extraordinarily important. I really developed a taste for formalism early, and the possibilities of form. And I saw somebody like Auden, and you know later James Merrill, the restlessness. Of those writers and the way oftentimes poets or poems were puzzles, and that's great fun for me still because I love writing in forms and I love trying out things and seeing how I can piece it together and you know still maintain the tension
right.
of that you know I sort of figured out early that I didn't. There's no point in doing this, and I sort of had to do it because for some reason I've always known since I can remember that I wanted to play with words, so there was just no point in fighting it, so I gave in pretty early. But I knew that I wanted to have some fun with it, you know? I mean, I hear a lot of people whine and complain about the drudgery of writing, and I'm just like, really? I mean, you have this wonderful opportunity, and you have this thing that you get to be obsessed with, which is what I am. I'm obsessed. My life has a second story, and that's that I get to be a poet. So I wanted to make sure that it was fun, and I have great fun playing with forms and trying to find new possibilities in the everyday. And so many of those poets that I mentioned taught me that. But, you know, I was just looking at Frost and Moore the other day. I mean, I turned back to these people whom I looked at early, and it's still really rich for me. Those are two poets, for example, that it seems like they're what they have to say deepens for me the more I read them, and they're clear, they're crystal clear poets. You know, there's nothing in Frost that I think, wow, I even need to look up that word or something. You know, with Frost, right. It's just always so much of the best of Frost. There's a lot of bad Frost. The best of Frost is sort of what isn't being said, you know? So, anyway, that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, that's a great answer. And, you know, it's at times like these that I am so pleased that I have a PhD in American poetry because, you know, what you're saying kind of guides me through a lot of the poets that were important to me. I'm so glad that you touched on Donald Justice because he's a poet who both my little brother and I, and my brother was a New England poet for a while. He won the Glasscock Poetry Award, which Lowell and Plath also won.
Oh, wow.
But Donald Justice was so important to us, and I forget now how it was I came across that first selected poetry. But I had it, and then I left it out for my brother Oliver, and he picked it up, and it was just so important to him. I think it kind of launched both of us in this kind of writing and thoughtful and contemplative and poetic trajectory that our lives have taken. And yet, Dana Joy and others have written about, he's kind of underappreciated and not widely as anthologized as many other poets who have written, say, that the chestnuts that are bound to come up in introductory poetry classes at modern universities.
You know, I agree, and I mean, it's tough for me to overstate how important Justice is to me, especially, you know, to how I came to be a poet, you know, a younger poet. I mean, he too was interested in forms and free verse, and he did both of them extraordinarily well. And the way that he moved away from form, I mean, the way he had some great villanelles and, you know, the one about There Is No Music Now in Arkansas.
Right.
You know, his most beautiful villanelle for me is Villanelle Sundown. Turn your head, look, the light is turning yellow. The river seems enriched thereby, not to say deepened. And why this is, I'll never be able to tell you. And he moves away from the strictness of that very complicated form, perhaps the most difficult form to write, I think. And he does it so beautifully, and he moves away from it in a way that, you know, it's almost, for me, it's almost as good as the way Elizabeth Bishop moves away from it in one art, the way she takes liberties.
Right.
But he's just written some wonderful poems. I mean, his Pantoum of the Great Depression showed me how to write a Pantoum. I mean, in that Pantoum, which is also very difficult, repetitive form, and I'm sorry, I'm mentioning all these forms, and I'm sure probably some of your listeners aren't familiar with all the intricacies, but it suffices to say that it's a difficult, repetitive form. And he does that, and almost every single line of that Pantoum is end-stopped, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's a marvelous. I mean, it's...
Which is so hard to do. If you read Pope, you can find that way.
Never mind the difficult form anyway, but
yeah.
That poem taught me, and I have, you know, I've like three Pantoums, but that poem... He taught me how to write a Pantoum, you know, and, but you know, it's like, you know, like William Logan once wrote about someone else. I mean, death is often the review from which many people don't recover, you know, so it's, you know, I mean, he was a minor poet. He was a poet's poet. And as they used to say, and, you know, no one's reading him, but he's in my small corner of what matters. And I hope for a revival. I think I'd love to write an essay. I have this idea for an essay on Donald Justice where it's sort of like I would call him the anti-nostalgist, because I believe that there's this conception. And in the worst of his poems, perhaps he's nostalgic. But for me, he skirts nostalgia in such a way, but he pulls away from it in ways that I have yet to formulate a coherent essay or a thesis about, that I really love to write about that and push against the idea that he's some sort of like, you know, just sort of this backward-looking sort of sentimental Orpheus.
Right. Because a lot of the topics and even the titles of his poems might lead one to that impression at first. But the poems themselves are they're complex. They explore contradiction and resistance to those very subjects as well as they might be typically interpreted.
Right. You know, and that Pantomime is a good instance. You know, it's the Pantomime of the Great Depression, and it keeps looking back. You know, the last line is, "And there is no plot in that semicolon. It is devoid of poetry." You know. He's not saying that it was either more or less than anything that it was. It was, and it was worth writing about, and he did it in a way that was very matter-of-fact, and it was matter-of-fact in that poem, so it was, you know, so moving because, obviously, you don't need to add any more distress to Great Depression. It's already a terrible time, so he just presented it in such a way that it's like, here's this, and as he presented it, the aggregate was that it got sort of more and more powerful, and it's, you know, it's a beautiful poem, so.
Absolutely.
Anyway, on and on.
Well, I remember when Robert Haas featured it in his Poet's Choice column in Washington Post, which was my hometown newspaper, and I appreciated Haas doing that good work on behalf of Donald Justice. Yeah. All right, well, here we are. It's 5:53, and I could go on for another hour and a half like this, but I think folks at home would also like to hear one of your poems. So let me remind people that Randall Mann is my guest this afternoon on Dr. Randy's Poetry and Technology Hour. He's the author of a couple important books of poetry, as well as the popular anthology, which is called, what's the name of your anthology?
Writing Poems.
Writing Poems. Right, the textbook Writing Poems. Which is, I'm sure, another way that you've been forced to think about what's important poetry and what's important poetry to you, and how can you get some of those favorite gems before the eyes of school children and college kids.
Absolutely, yeah. It was one of the pleasures of helping to edit that, was adding poems that I really loved.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Randall, do you have a poem there of your own that you could share with me and with listeners to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour?
Sure. I'll read one from Breakfast with Tom Gunn.
Great, thanks.
Election Day. God is an art. Early in the century, he's pragmatism. I need him in this little city by the sea. The day does its melancholy thing. I come home, watch pornography, fast forward the scenes in which a friend, back in his methamphetamine years, has unrepeatable things done to him. On the street, a bag of paranoia costs less than a moderately priced meal out. I'll stay in, tired of the age of irony, everything a gesture, tired of the word gesture. The day ends as the world will end. 11 o'clock news, our charmingly corrupt mayor incredulous. And a beautiful shot of uncounted ballots floating in the bay.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you.
From Breakfast with Tom Gunn, and tell me the title again.
Election Day.
Election Day. Randall, what sort of plans or projects or enterprises are you currently working on or hatching?
Well, I've just been working on some new poems the last 3 or so years since I finished Breakfast with Tom Gunn have been a really good writing time for me. So, I may be coming to the tail end of finishing another book, but I don't know. I've always been not the fastest writer, so I'm going to, I'll just put them together and see, and we'll see how they all look together. I'm just trying to publish these poems and write them, and ever so slowly writing a few essays here and there. I'd love to be able to have more time, but, life conspires to keep poets from writing prose, I think. So, ever so slowly. I have ideas. That's the great thing. I have ideas. I just have to find the time. So, poems with prose when I'm forced to do it, or when I just when I feel like I just absolutely need to write it. I'd love to write this justice essay, but yeah. So.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to your next book, and I'm going to go pick myself up a copy of Breakfast with Tom Gunn. I'll remind folks that it's a 2009 publication, University of Chicago Press. Randall Mann, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you, and I hope that you'll drop me a line when you've got something else to plug, because I'd love to have part two of this conversation about great American poetry and also celebrate those poets from other countries who warrant it, because the poets that you've brought up, I think it's important for people to add them to their bucket list of people who they should review during this lifetime. So thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Same here. Take care.
Okay, you too.
That was Randall Mann, the San Francisco-based poet. And again, his most recent book, Breakfast with Tom Gunn. A little bit more music and then a public service announcement before we conclude. This is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS 90.3 FM, Davis. Public service announcement now. If you are a young person and need a safe, non-judgmental place to talk about problems in your life, then you can call the California Youth Crisis Line. For more than 15 years, their crisis counselors have been helping teens with their problems. You can call anytime, day or night, to speak with a crisis counselor about any type of concern. This call is free and confidential, and it won't show up on your phone bill. The number is 1-800-843-5200. We are just about out of time this afternoon on this Public Affairs Radio Show. I'd like to thank my two guests, Millicent Borges-Accardi from Los Angeles and Randall Mann from San Francisco, two very talented poets. I very much enjoyed the conversations about their poetic heroes and about their new works. If you ever have questions about authors who we interview or bring up on this program, feel free to drop me a line, my university email address, for I teach here at the University of California, Davis, and have for the last 20 years, is aojones@ucdavis.edu. You can also reach me at aojones@gmail.com. Tonight, I'll be attending the Molly Fisk Poetry Reading, part of the Poetry Night Reading Series, this evening at Bistro 33. Molly Fisk is a multiple prize-winning poet out of Nevada City, who will be reading starting at 8 o'clock tonight. Opening for her will be Zoe Keithley, and there will be an open mic at 9 o'clock. So if you, too, have something to share with the local poetic community, you're heartily encouraged to stop by Bistro 33 tonight for some free poetic entertainment. Next week on this program, I've got some more poets who are vying for your attention, as well as the opportunity to talk about their work and read some of it. Thanks to all of you for tuning in to KDBS this afternoon. Stick around for some great music, and I'll see you next week for another edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Talk to you then.